the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Happy holidays, folks, and welcome to the Scholar's Corner, episode number 4, Thomas Jefferson. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thank you, Andy. It is good to be back, and I want to first off by saying thank you to all of our listeners out there and all of our fans. Me and Andy do appreciate you downloading our podcast and listening to us, and before we get started today, I believe Andy has something he wants to say toward our listeners.
Yes, the bandwidth we have exceeded for a basic account on Podomatic, which is where we broadcast our website. So we do have a link where you can donate to our podcast. If you feel so inclined, you can go to Google and just Google us, the Scholar's Corner, and it'll pull up our Podomatic page. And there's a link to PayPal to donate. Or you can go to paypal.com directly and navigate your way to send money. And you can send money to my email address, which is ajlemon@mel.usi.edu. I'd also like to mention that a month ago, we got done with the John Adams podcast. And our goal with all these podcasts is to try and complete them under 60 minutes. And we did so with John Adams. I think the total broadcast time was 63 minutes and change.
All right, Andy, why don't we just jump right in here, and let's start Thomas Jefferson.
We'll try and do it under 60, but it's looks like it's going to be
a doozy. It's a doozy. We got a lot of information here. So let's just get started. Jump right in.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new gods for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having indirect object, the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
Starting with Jefferson's early life, he was born on April 13th, 1743, at the Blue Ridge Mountains in Virginia, just outside of present-day Charlottesville. And Jefferson was born in a house his father, Peter, named Shadwell, which was on a 1,400-acre estate. In 1757, Peter Jefferson died, and Thomas would inherit the estate in 1764 upon turning 21 years old. And just on a small hill west of Shadwell is where Thomas Jefferson would build Monticello. And shortly after he inherits the land and starts to build Monticello, Shadwell would burn down. And you can actually visit the large plantation of Monticello today, either in person or at www.monticello.org, and that's spelled MONTICELLO.org. The website offers a 3D model for viewing the plantation. It's really interactive, and
it looks beautiful. We both went there, and that's just a beautiful home. Yeah. And it's still intact.
Yes.
I mean, you got to think when this thing was built, and it's still the same way it was built. Definitely check that one out. That one's one to look at.
You definitely, and the website, you can navigate through everything from the gardens to his experimentation plot, which was out front of the house, and he experimented with different types of trees and different types of corn and different farming methods. It's pretty neat. I mean, I'd give it a look. If you visit the Monticello in person, I would suggest the wine tour. I do believe it's close to $50 a person, but it's well worth it. Thomas Jefferson had a long-standing interest in wine and grape-growing experimentation. And he is regarded as America's first viticulturist.
You know, I'm going to stop you right there. This is kind of weird. What was George Washington first at? First brewer?
I think it was the largest distillery.
That's right. That's right. I just thought that weird with the two presidents drinking a lot, you know?
That is funny. He was growing... producing the largest amount of whiskey in like 1799.
That's right.
His interest, Jefferson's interest in wine, would come from his time spent abroad in Europe. This is where he would visit the vineyards with his spare time, and John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, they would accompany him on these tours. And as President of the United States, Jefferson purchased over 20,000 bottles of wine, some of which are on display at Monticello.
I wonder how much you could buy one for.
I don't know, but they were saying that they're over 200 years old, some of the bottles. Just insane.
Like, is the wine still in them?
No, they're uncorked. That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, there's pictures of it online. Jefferson would actually serve as wine advisor to Presidents Washington, Madison, and Monroe. And he wrote to Presidents Monroe's Secretary of State, "I think it a great error to consider a heavy tax on wines as a tax on luxury. On the contrary, it is a tax on the health of our citizens."
Well, I guess it is safe to say, Andy, that the man was pretty heavily involved in his wine. I believe he liked to drink a little bit. What, a wine advisor? Yeah. How much does that pay?
Really, to Washington, Madison, and Monroe. Yeah. Like they were nobody.
Yeah, like they'd never had wine. Right. Grape or white or red wine,
the
sir.
The guy was obviously an expert in the field of grapes.
Yeah.
So, Jefferson, after spending a childhood studying at different schools, he enrolled at the College of William and Mary in 1760 at the age of 17. Not quite John Adams, like when John Adams enrolled in Harvard at 16, but he's close. 17, William and Mary.
Still considered him a genius.
Pretty smart. When Peter Jefferson was on his deathbed in 1757, this prior to him enrolling in college, he had made Thomas promise him that he would continue his study, and Thomas did keep that promise. What is interesting about this is that Peter Jefferson had no formal education, but he had a great respect for education, and he loved books.
And that goes back to John Adams. Didn't he have the quote?
Yes, John Adams had the quote after that one lady had dumped him,
mm-hmm.
And he said that, "Do not let any woman pry you from your books. Don't let any woman pry you from your tobacco, your guns, or your books." And also, if you go to the Library of Congress website, there's actually a portrait they sell of Thomas Jefferson, and it has a quote below it that said, "I love books." So it's pretty straightforward. They also offer that in a desk model if you have a cubicle at work. So it's $28, I believe. During Jefferson's study at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Jefferson fell in with a group of fellow students who would later serve in public office with him. He also joined a secret society called the FHC Society, which stood for the Flat Hat Club.
Flat. So is the early day Skull and Bones? Is that what we're saying?
I think so. So it looks like the FHC Society is actually the first recorded college society within the territory of the United States.
Interesting.
Williamsburg, at the time, was the state capital of Virginia, and is also where the House of Burgesses would convene, as well as the General Court. The governor of Virginia also resided in Williamsburg, and Jefferson was included in the gatherings at the governor's palace. His inclusion was due to his college professors, who were impressed by the bright and talented Thomas Jefferson. Thomas gained valuable insight to political leadership at the governor's palace, and it was the most interactive classroom he ever attended. After 2 years at the College of William and Mary, Jefferson decided to pursue a legal career. One of his professors, George Wythe, who is also a famous colonial patriot, would teach Jefferson law. And in May of 1765, Wythe instructed his students to go to the Capitol, where the members of the House of Burgesses were debating their stance on the Stamp Act. And this is where Jefferson saw Patrick Henry, and Henry was voicing his opposition to Parliament and King George III so strongly that some of the members of the House of Burgesses yelled, "Treason! Treason!" To which Henry replied, "If this be treason, make the most of it."
And I also want to bring in a quote by Patrick Henry, which is one of my favorites. He also said, "Give me liberty or give me death."
So, one of Thomas Jefferson, who he's looking up to here and watching, is like his hands-on instructor, Patrick Henry.
A patriot.
Not a bad guy to be learning after. And this memory would stick with Jefferson throughout his life. He would say, "Patrick Henry spoke as Homer wrote." In 1767, Jefferson passes the bar. And from 1768 to 1773, Jefferson would handle over 100 cases each year. He would take cases from the General Court for 2 years before being elected to the House of Burgesses. And around this time is when he began work on Monticello. Jefferson also meets Martha Wells, and they married on January the 1st, 1772, bringing in the new year 1772 in style with a nice wife. And over the course of their marriage, unfortunately, they would have 6 children, most of which would die. I think the one that lived to be the longest was their first, Martha Jefferson Randolph. She lived from 1772 to 1836 and was 58 years old. The next one, Jane Randolph, died at 1 year old. A third, an unnamed son, was stillborn. Fourth, Mary Epes, she actually lived to be 26. The fifth, Lucy Elizabeth, died at 1. And then the sixth, Lucy Elizabeth again, died at 3 years old. It was said that the childbearing problems were due to diabetes that Martha is believed to have suffered from.
All right, Andy, enough with the early life. It's time to jump into the good stuff. The revolution.
Revolution started off.
Okay, Jefferson's world, it would be halted by the actions of the Sons of Liberty. Now, the Sons of Liberty, they are known for the Boston Tea Party, which where they dressed as Indians and they dumped an entire shipment of tea into Boston's harbor. What a lot of people don't know, and this is just a little extra, is Ben Franklin at this time was actually in France, and he actually was doing some diplomatic work with them. He paid for the tea that the colonists threw out, but as a cause, this still caused strains with, you know, strained relations with Britain. The resulting towns and acts took effect, also known as the Course of Acts.
Jefferson would write a pamphlet, the Summary View of Rights of British America, Thus his name would become associated with the rebels who were forming the rebellion and the Tea Party, and he proclaimed his loyalty to the mother country.
And I'm going to jump in real quick on the Sons of Liberty, and me and you have talked about this novel, but Johnny Tremaine, it's nonfiction. Well, no, it's fiction. It's a fictional story based on facts on the Sons of Liberty. Real good book. Most of you probably read it in high school, but if you haven't, definitely check it out. It's a good read.
Jefferson would actually say, "Believe me, dear sir, there is not in the British Empire a man who more cordially loves the Union with Great Britain than I do. But by the God that made me, I will cease to exist before I yield to a connection on such terms as the British Parliament propose. And in this, I think I speak the sentiments of America." In 1775, Jefferson would become a delegate to the Second Continental Congress of Philadelphia. And pay attention here. Thomas Jefferson was not elected delegate to the First Continental Congress. He was not elected delegate to the Second Continental Congress. It was only after Virginia delegate Peyton Randolph, who was serving as president of the Second Continental Congress, was summoned back to Virginia to the House of Burgesses 2 weeks into the Second Continental Congress that Jefferson was called upon. It was then that John Hancock would become president of the Second Continental Congress after Peyton Randolph would leave.
Now, John Adams called Jefferson the best writer in Congress. Now, in June of 1776, when a committee was appointed to write the Declaration of Independence, it was easy justifiable that Jefferson would be their choice.
Right, and as we discussed in episode number 3, John Adams was already on 22 other committees and had advised that he himself did not have time to write the Declaration. Jefferson completed the document in 17 days, and some historians feel that the other members of the committee scrutinized the Declaration of Independence and made numerous changes to it. However, the Scholar's Corner would have to disagree here.
Yes, we do disagree. As we also pointed out in episode 3, the committee made changes to the document not because they felt like they needed to edit Jefferson's work or scrutinize his work, but because they all wanted a hand in the document to ensure that it passed the Congress.
Right, this early politicking. Remember, in Congress, even though there were 56 members, membership numbers varied. It was 56 or so. There were only 13 votes, one for each colony. The committee consisted of 5 members from 5 different states, thus ensuring their vote. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, Roger Livingston, all being from different states. However, the editing discomforted Jefferson, and he would make several copies of his original and use them to take notes on during discussion of the document by Congress.
So he was pretty proud of his work.
So he was proud of his work. And I think we should discuss, maybe not in detail, but just at least mention that there is some debate about when the document was signed. July 4th, right, Justin?
That's what we say. We say Independence Day, but weren't we, didn't you tell me a story that is debatable?
Yeah, basically, a lot of historians disagree, and we looked it up in the journal entries of the Second Continental Congress, and it talks about, like, an entry on July 19th. It says that it calls to have all the states sign the Declaration, and then another entry on August the 2nd, stating that all the states have come to the table to sign it. And it makes sense because, you know, 56-member Congress, there was hardly ever a day when all 56 people were there. So to say that all the members were there on July 4th and signed it, it'd be really hard to believe. So there's a lot of discussion back and forth between historians about whether or whether or not it was truly signed on July 4th.
I guess the 4th of July sounds better than the 2nd of August or the 15th of July.
It's true.
4th of July sounds more patriotic.
We should just have two holidays since there is no holiday in August. At least not for me.
It's my birthday in August.
Oh, so congratulations.
Hey,
did you
holiday.
Take the day off?
I try not to, but I wish they'd give it to me.
Well, once the Second Continental Congress had adjoined, Thomas Jefferson returned home to help with the drafting of the state constitution, and this would be one of his finer works, one that he wanted to be remembered for. Jefferson singled out one area in particular, that of religious freedom. And Jefferson believed that not only did the state of Virginia have to break ties with the mother country, but also the Church of England as well. And Jefferson would create what is now known as the separation of church and state.
Which has been debated up till today on certain instances. And it all started here.
And the Pledge of Allegiance, which we start our podcast out, can no longer be preached or sung in school. I remember when I was in elementary school, it was always sung at the beginning of the day. Pledge of Allegiance to this flag of the United States of America. And we can't do it anymore because in like the 60s, I believe it was, they added one nation under God is what they had added.
And then it became separation to pledge to your country.
Yep. You can't sing it no more in schools. The view, however, was deemed radical by everybody. Looked at Jefferson like he was crazy. And it would be several years before his philosophy passed the Virginia Assembly. And it would do so with the help of James Madison, who was one of Jefferson's homeboys. I mean, that's his guy. They're best friends. Jefferson knew who to be friends with, and that was definitely one of his fortes. In 1779, Jefferson would be elected governor of Virginia. And the first thing he did, and I would say he was an expert at it, since he went to Williamsburg for the William and Mary, he oversaw the move of the state capital from Williamsburg to Richmond, Virginia, a more central location. And he believed that the state capital should be more centralized to reflect the westward movement. And he pushed for many reforms at his alma mater, the College of William and Mary, including the nation's first student policed honor code, and appointing George Wythe to be the first professor of law in an American university.
All right, and in 1780, Jefferson joined Benjamin Franklin's American Philosophical Society, where he would serve as president from 1797 to 1815. Now, in 1781, during the Revolutionary War, the British invaded Virginia. Now, what happened was Jefferson and his family had to move around repeatedly for risk of being taken prisoner, which was what the Britain was actually doing to, you know, these people of power at the time.
Right. And by the end of the year, charges of cowardice were flung at Jefferson. People charged Jefferson for being incapable of handling the invasions adequately. And Jefferson would consequently retire to Monticello, where he would read and work on his book, Notes on the State of Virginia.
What kind of book is the Notes of State Virginia?
Yeah, well, I'm guessing it is like a memoir of his time with the state government. Just taking a stab at it. I have no idea. I haven't looked into it.
I've never even heard of it.
It was one of his most popular works, though. So
had to be proud of it.
Maybe not most popular, but highly regarded. In May 1782, Martha Jefferson would give birth to their sixth child. And, unfortunately, she would die on September 6th of the same year due to complications with the birth. Jefferson promised Martha that he would never remarry upon her death, a promise that he would keep. After her funeral, Jefferson would not leave his room for weeks. He was inconsolable in his loss.
Aw, poor guy. Lost his wife. He's sad.
And I mean, he was more than just sad, you know, he was just torn up. It changed his life, and for like 3 months, I think it was, he didn't leave his house, or his room. He finally went outside and was riding around on horseback alone, and he would just spend hours doing this each day.
Well, good thing he got his act together.
Well, James Madison was fearing for his friend's mental well-being, and he secured him a position in France. And actually, the position ended up falling through, but Jefferson moved to Philadelphia and became a member of Congress. And it is here where he took particular interest in the development of the Northwest Territory. And in 1784, the assignment in France actually came through. So they're just going back to France now. And it is France where he would be reunited with Benjamin Franklin and John Adams.
You know, it's amazing that these guys are in France. You know, you think of, with all, right now in our podcasting, we talk, you know, the colonies, Great Britain, and France. And Britain hates France, Britain hates us, We need France. I mean, it just kind of feels like it's going back and forth here.
Right. It's funny because French and Indian War.
Right. Exactly.
The French and the Revolution were against the British with the French on our side. Like, it's like really weird.
For fear of being captured by Britain, and yet they're over in France where you'd think that they would just...
It all ties together. It's so amazing how all this just ties to one another. And you really got to stay on top of it. And if you study the presidents, which we are doing now, like our podcast just isn't going to be on presidents, but if you stay on the presidents, you get the large scope of American history, almost covers every detail in it, at least a little bit touches on it. So I think it's good, and we're going to stay the course for a little bit.
Yeah, I guess each president tells a different tale of the same story,
exactly.
So to speak.
While serving as minister to France, Jefferson would travel Europe. And it is here where he fell in love with wine. He also reestablished his friendship with Marquis de Lafayette. Let's touch on Marquis de Lafayette for a moment here. If you remember, he was in the American Revolution and served in the Continental Army under George Washington. He was wounded in the Battle of Brandywine, even though he organized a successful retreat. And during the French Revolution, he was leading the Garde Nationale. He tried to maintain order. He was ultimately persecuted by the Jacobins, and in 1791, as the radical factions in the revolution grew in power, Lafayette tried to flee to the United States through the Dutch Republic. He was captured by the Austrians and served nearly 5 years in prison. It wasn't until Napoleon Bonaparte...
Bonaparte!
Freed him from an Austrian prison in 1797.
And a little thing about this guy that I like is that James Monroe actually...
Oh, I thought you were going to say his hair.
His hair, yeah.
You should look at a picture of this guy.
He's in his wig. But actually, James Monroe invited this guy to the United States as the nation's guest, where he would visit all the 24 states, I guess, to give a little speech.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. Real quick, also Lafayette, he drafted the Declaration of Rights of Man and of Citizen for France. The document was actually designed after several of Jefferson's documents, mainly the Declaration of Independence.
Now, jumping back a bit, in 1787, Jefferson's friend, James Madison, wrote the Constitutional Convention. He forwarded a copy of the Constitution to Jefferson upon completion. Just jumping off topic here, how do you forward something like that? Oh, like, without email?
To France.
Without email,
it took months.
Yeah, right. Not like when you forward stuff to me, but yeah, anyway.
The Constitutional Convention was completed by the time Jefferson received the correspondence.
Well, Jefferson was immediately disturbed by lack of Bill of Rights. He found the omission unacceptable. In 1789, James Madison would present the Bill of Rights to the first United States Congress.
Right, and Jefferson also would introduce European foods to America.
Pizza? Spaghetti?
Well, no, none of that. But the new foods that he did bring back were vanilla ice cream, macaroni, fried potatoes, thank God.
I love you, brother.
Anchovies.
Yeah.
Figs. And broccoli.
Ugh, now,
could you imagine?
No, that's gross.
Well, what would we be without broccoli and fried potatoes, man?
Well,
vanilla ice cream? I mean, that's an American staple food.
You know, ice cream at the time was a delicacy at this time. And you know, I read somewhere, who I was reading, they had oyster-flavored ice cream. Oyster flavor? Gross.
I'm sorry, I still think about fried potatoes.
And stuff. Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Jefferson arrived home in 1789. He found President George Washington awaiting him and was offered the appointment of Secretary of State. Also appointed to Washington's cabinet was Alexander Hamilton as Secretary of Treasury. Hamilton and Jefferson would disagree on nearly every facet of government. Hamilton, a Federalist, thought the people should be ruled by the elite and supported a strong central government.
Well, Hamilton's getting his wish today.
Yes, he is.
Compared to...
Not that we're throwing our political beliefs fire. But
Stating the fact.
A lot of Federalists follow the democratic principles. So, the strong central government. Obviously, it's pretty unanimous that Democrats feel a strong central government. Jefferson, a Jeffersonian Republican, hence being a Republican, fancied the idea of the people ruling themselves. And he believed in the goodness of the common man and a society that allowed the people to be in control, with a weak central government allowing states more latitude. Hamilton would fashion a series of proposals to pay America's multi-million dollar debt. And Madison and Jefferson were looking to debate regarding the site of the new nation's capital. Over dinner, the three men agreed to support each other, and Hamilton's plan to pay back debt would be passed, as well as the South gaining the new capital. The actual location of Washington, D.C. was selected by George Washington. They did agree upon it being in the South. And another of Hamilton's propositions was for a national bank. Jefferson and Madison opposed the proposition. They argued that the U.S. Constitution did not call for a bank, so it was unconstitutional. And Hamilton pointed to the Article 1 allowing Congress to do whatever was necessary and proper. Thus the debate began on loose and strict interpretations of the Constitution. Today, I'd say we have a couple of national banks.
you got to think, though. Jefferson went by what the Constitution said. I mean, he didn't like to stray from it. He was strict to what it said.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And you know, back to the National Bank, I think it failed. They did away with it, I think, 1815 or 1825, that general time frame. And, you'd think that our government today would learn from history. And instead of bailing out banks and supporting them and trying to run them and set their bylaws and CEO compensation and trying to meddle in their affairs, they would learn from what happened in history that it doesn't work when the government tries to operate a bank.
It just didn't end. And it's not going to work now. Not at all.
Thereafter, in 1793, Jefferson tired of the continual struggle to win the president's approval, and he retired. During his retirement, Washington refused to run for a third term, and the Democratic Republicans ran their founder, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was severely mismatched, but constitutional rules supported the person who finished second would become vice president. So, therefore, John Adams president, Thomas Jefferson vice president.
Whereas that's different today. They actually select who their vice president's going to be.
Right, and they would, which actually comes up in the election of 1804, the 12th Amendment had been ratified, and it was largely undue because of the election of 1800, which is the very next election after Thomas Jefferson ran against John Adams the first time in 1796. And in the election of 1800, there were some problems, and in the election of 1804, the 12th Amendment was added. And that would specify that the president gets to pick their vice president.
And as we know, leaving office, the second president and the third president didn't see eye to eye.
Sure.
There was no welcome to the office.
No.
Like that.
No, there wasn't. We'll get all into that in detail here momentarily. Jefferson would take his appointment as vice president very seriously, and he believed that senators needed guidelines. So Jefferson wrote the Manual of Parliament Practice. And that soon became the rule book for both houses of Congress and remains so today. And starting with President Washington's treatment of Adams as vice president, presidents did not allow their vice presidents into their cabinet meetings. Meetings between Adams and Jefferson were usually cold. Things only got worse with the XYZ affair. As we discussed in episode number 3, the affair was a demand for a bribe from French officials requesting money to meet with American diplomats. And rather than to disclose their names, Adams assigned the names as Misters X, Y, and Z. And this looked bad on Jefferson, who was always at the defense of France. He spent a lot of time in France, and he always sided with them. Adams passed the Alien and Sedition Acts, also discussed in Episode 3, And just to reiterate here, the Alien Act tightened citizenship requirements and also allowed the president to deport people he believed to be a threat to national security, namely anti-federalist, which John Adams was a federalist. The Sedition Act made it illegal to publish or speak out against the Adams administration, namely journalists, Democratic Republican journalists.
Now, what we were speaking about earlier, the election of 1800, also known as the Revolution of 1800, exposed a flaw with the Constitution. Each electoral college could only vote for president, but each could place two votes. Now, Jefferson easily defeated Adams, who had finished third in the voting. It left Jefferson and his running mate, Burr, tied. 35 times the House voted, and 35 times the House tied. It wasn't until the final push came from the Federalist, Alexander Hamilton, who didn't like his choices, but favored Jefferson over Burr.
Right, and Jefferson would deliver his inaugural speech that spoke of reconciliation. He was the first president to be inaugurated in Washington, D.C.
And what we see here is Burr and Hamilton. Their first encounter, which is what we're going to lead to later on.
Right.
We'll tell our nice little story of what's going to happen.
Yes, a great story, too. Which leads us into the presidency of Thomas Jefferson.
Da-da-da!
The first thing he did, revoked the Alien and Sedition Acts.
It sucked.
Right in John Adams' face. And he did so for their unconstitutionality once his administration was in office.
Unconstitutionality. Now, that's something that's going to come up, as Jefferson has always said in his lifetime. It's unconstitutional, unconstitutional.
Right.
I just want to pound that in everybody's brain, because later on, we're going to tell a little story that kind of goes against this.
It's like everything with Jefferson's life leads into the next.
Yes.
James Callender, a journalist, was placed in jail for a year after being charged with violating the Sedition Act. He had referred to President Adams as a spy for the British. He wrote of Washington as a scandalous hypocrite, accusing Washington of robbing his own army. Callender, who was a supporter of Jefferson, requested the position of postmaster. Jefferson refused the offer, but offered to refund 25% of his fine. Callender was upset with only a partial payment and threatened to expose Jefferson's secrets unless he received more money. Well, Jefferson, of course, ignores Callender. He did not want to be blackmailed. And Callender wrote of Jefferson's mistress, a slave named Sally. Sally Hemings was a slave that worked for Jefferson. She supposedly gave birth to Jefferson's children. The relationship was to have begun in France when Jefferson took his slave Sally and another slave with him. There was some testing done in 1998. It was a DNA test, and it confirmed that one of Sally Hemings' children was fathered by Jefferson.
Hold on, whoa. A DNA test?
Yes.
They had it back then?
No, this was done in 1998.
Oh, I'm sorry, 98.
Yes, sir. And they couldn't prove Thomas was the father, since no DNA has ever been recovered from him. However, they did prove that the child supposedly fathered in France was not Jefferson's. The Thomas Jefferson Foundation, who runs Monticello, and the Thomas Jefferson Heritage Society have both released contradictory reports based off of the DNA test. They accuse each other of false conclusions. And the story makes for a bit of scholarly drama. However, Callender was known for his poisonous pen, so to speak, and in 1803, a drunken Callender would drown in 3 feet of water.
Surprisingly not beer.
Yeah, really. You know what's interesting is when Jefferson's wife died, he promised not to ever marry another woman. Okay. Well, it's not like he was promising to abstain. So, did he sleep with other women? I would think so. You know, especially in France. I mean,
hey, we all get drunk.
Well, you know, I'm being kind of serious. I think he probably did sleep with Sally. It's not like he's going to be
marry her.
Practice abstinence.
Yeah.
You know, he obviously wouldn't want that to get out, because at the time, sleeping with a slave was not that popular.
Mm.
As president of the United States, not something you want to talk about to a lot of people. So, well, he made good on his campaign promise. to cut taxes on items produced domestically, thus ending the whiskey tax originally levied by Washington. Remember the Whiskey Rebellion? Washington leads the troops up to Pennsylvania and shuts down the Whiskey Rebellion?
Without a fight. Without a fight.
Mm-hmm. Jefferson was opposed to gun control. Thank God.
Him and Charles Heston have been good friends.
Laws that forbid the carrying of arms disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. They serve rather to encourage than to prevent homicides, for an unarmed man may be attacked with greater confidence than an armed man.
Translated, people kill people. Guns don't kill people.
Right. I think the NRA, hopefully they're listening to our podcast, and they can take that quote and put it on a t-shirt. Jefferson was the first president to suggest an Indian removal program. Andrew Jackson is often credited with initiating Indian removal since Congress passed the Indian Removal Act in 1830. However, Jefferson brought the idea to the table. We'd also like to mention, we don't have time to cover it, but Marbury versus Madison was a landmark case in United States law, and it formed the basis for the exercise of judicial review in the United States. Basically, it was part of, Marbury was part of the Midnight Judges that John Adams had appointed, and had appointed to the Supreme Court to keep Federalists in power. The appointment never took place, and there was a court case that ensued. And like I said, we don't have time to cover it, but if you should research this if you want to know everything Thomas Jefferson. This was a huge part of his presidency.
This was the first time the Supreme Court declared something, going back to Thomas Jefferson, unconstitutional.
Basically, the court did render a unanimous 4-0 decision that Marbury had the right to his commission, but the court did not have the power to force Madison to deliver the commission. So he was never appointed his commission. Jefferson and his Secretary of State, Meriwether Lewis, let's remember that name, lived in the newly constructed President's House. I guess they were roomies. He assigned Lewis the task of reducing the military. Ironically, he would become the first president to send troops to foreign soil to fight. And Tripoli had demanded payment from the U.S. and other countries for years for safe passage through the Mediterranean Sea. Tripoli announced that they wanted more money, and Jefferson refused. Tripoli declared war against U.S. May 10, 1801, and the first Barbary War would take place when it was mostly a naval campaign. Tripoli, for geography purposes, is in Libya, located in northern Africa along the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, and this is where the USS Philadelphia is captured by pirates in 1803, and its guns were turned against other American ships. In 1804, Stephen Decatur led a small group of U.S. Marines into the Tripoli Harbor. They used a captured Tripolonian ship that was rechristened USS Intrepid to deceive the guards on board the Philadelphia. They were able to get close enough to storm the Philadelphia, overtake the guards, and set the ship on fire.
Yes, and there's actually a famous piece of art.
No, it's a good-looking piece, too.
It's the USS Philadelphia burning, and the USS Intrepid fleeing the scene. The painting is called Burning of the Frigate Philadelphia in the Harbor of Tripoli, February 16, 1804, and it was painted by Edward Moran in 1897. And the USS Philadelphia is ablaze shortly after she was boarded and set afire by a party from the Intrepid, and it was led by Lieutenant Stephen Decatur. The painting is in the U.S. Naval Academy Museum collection, and it was a gift of Paul Sutro in 1940. Amazing picture. You should look it up online. It's really neat. And that leads us to the Battle of Dern, the first land battle of the United States on foreign soil. And we got to tell a story here, of course, right?
Story time.
General William Eaton would take a group of 10 U.S. Marines to Egypt. Here he recruited 500 mercenaries. So, things like Blackwater, which is now called Z, by the way, it's spelled X-E. it's not something new. You know, we're using them in Iraq, we're using them in Afghanistan. It's not new. It was happening in the 1800s, early 1800s, the Battle of Tripoli. Anyway, he leads a 500-mile trek from Egypt across the Libyan desert to the port city of Derne. The hike took nearly 2 months. And once at Derne, Eaton and his men were met by three ships from the U.S. Navy who supplied the men with provisions. After 2 days of rest, the three ships from the U.S. Navy opened fire on the Ottoman forces and their batteries. Eaton, grabbing a rifle and shouting, "Charge!" led the forces over the walls. The Marines would capture the governor's palace, block the road to Tripoli, and seize the Ottomans' batteries in 1 hour and 15 minutes. Complete annihilation.
Shock and awe.
There is a story that the Ottoman soldiers left in such a hurry that they left their cannons loaded, which the U.S. Marines turned and used on the city. One of the lieutenants raised the U.S. flag over the city, and for the first time, the American flag is flown over fortifications on that side of the Atlantic. The Ottomans sent reinforcements, but all their attacks would be repelled by the U.S. U.S. forces, 2 killed, 3 wounded. Ottomans, 800 killed and 1,200 wounded, a decisive U.S. victory. However, before Eaton can move his force to Tripoli, the Treaty of Tripoli is signed in 1805. And the attack on the city actually inspired a portion of the lyrics of the Marines hymn that mentions, "To the shores of Tripoli." Even though they were never on the shores of Tripoli. It's the Battle of Derne.
Oh, you told that story well. I was on pins and needles the whole time.
Were you?
Yeah.
The Battle of Derne. Inspired "To the shores of Tripoli." Anyway.
You get the gist. All right. Now, New Orleans is a vital port for the United States, especially during the early 1800s, as the Mississippi and Ohio Rivers were major thoroughfares for commerce, and New Orleans was the gateway. Whomever controls the port of New Orleans controls the access to the Mississippi.
Right, and at the time, Spain controlled the port of New Orleans and the entire Louisiana Territory. That was until 1803, when Napoleon conquered Spain, and the Louisiana Territory was one of his prizes of the war.
And Napoleon's in our podcast again.
Yes, he is. And Napoleon had a grand vision of expanding the French Empire into the Americas. Unfortunately, that faded after bills had accumulated from years of fighting in Europe and his defeat in Egypt.
Now, I just want people to think right now that had Napoleon had his way, everything basically west of the Mississippi River would have been France occupied.
Sure.
I mean, easily, if he wouldn't have been at war and had all this debt.
Right, and if Jefferson wasn't buddies with France.
Yeah, exactly.
In 1803, Jefferson dispatched diplomats to France to negotiate for Port of New Orleans and West Florida. No one feared Napoleon as United States' new neighbor as much as Jefferson. I can see why. To the diplomat's surprise, Napoleon offered to sell the whole Louisiana Territory to the United States for $15 million, which is much more than they had allowed for spending. But the diplomats thought the president would approve, so they made the deal. And the Louisiana Purchase was bought for 3 cents an acre. Now, you'll hear that over and over in history. Louisiana Purchase was bought for 3 cents an acre. But he bought it because of the port of New Orleans and the Mississippi River. So some historians will say, and it's a little bit wiser to say this, Napoleon didn't sell the Louisiana Purchase for 3 cents an acre. He sold it for 4 cents a gallon.
Now, this basically doubled the size of our country. Now, getting back to everything, Jefferson went by the book. Constitution, Constitution, Constitution. Buying this land was considered unconstitutional. And he actually went back and forth in his head. Even with this good deal, he was hesitant to do it. Now, we know this as being one of his greatest achievements, if not his greatest achievement in office. But in his mind, he didn't feel that this was the right thing to do. He thought it was unconstitutional, and he wanted to set example. Later, people would attack him and saying that you went against the Constitution. You did something unconstitutional. He had to do it because it doubled the size of our country.
Sure. And it would be one of his greatest achievements in office. Might separate him as being the greatest president ever, this one achievement. But he had several. Lewis and Clark expedition. Jefferson had always dreamed of sending an expedition to map the territory west of the Mississippi for many years. And he contacted George Rogers Clark in the 1780s to lead the expedition. Unfortunately, the plans never materialized. George Rogers Clark, we will cover him in a future podcast. But in 1803, Jefferson would send the military expedition west with Meriwether Lewis as captain and William Clark as his co-captain. Ironically, William Clark is George Rogers Clark's younger brother. Now, what's funny, and we'll just throw this out there, Meriwether Lewis and William Clark are both Freemasons. We'll get into this in a second. Thomas Jefferson, rumored to be a Freemason.
Yeah, and going back to Lewis and Clark expedition, we were discussing this earlier today. This is actually an American epic tale. We really don't have time to go into it in detail because, I mean, you could go into this and spend a whole podcast going over what they did. But this is actually considered the great American epic. And there's actually, in St. Louis, at the Arch, where my Cardinals play, the gateway to the West, there's actually a museum at the bottom of the Arch dedicated to the Lewis and Clark expedition. And I've been there several times. It's wonderful. If you guys get a chance, check it out, because it basically shows, it talks about this expedition and what it meant for the country.
Right. The expedition was actually called the Corps of Discovery, and their goal was to map the Mississippi and the Western Territory, take notes on flora, fauna, soil, weather, and natives they encountered. Back to Thomas Jefferson being a Freemason. This was most likely due to his association with prominent Freemasons such as George Washington, James Madison, James Monroe, Meriwether Lewis, William Clark, Benjamin Franklin, Dr. Benjamin Rush, Lafayette. All of these people are prominent Freemasons. However, in 1960, a Masonic scholar and Freemason member, William Denslow, completed work at the Missouri Lodge of Research, which is in St. Louis, and concluded that Jefferson's claims to membership were based on association. There is no documentation on record of Jefferson's membership to any lodge. I would like to say that nobody more than the Freemasons would like to be acquainted with Thomas Jefferson's membership to the fraternity. So if they say it didn't exist, it didn't exist. And this place, the Freemason Research Facility in Missouri, is similar to NASA and scientific discoveries. So, I mean, if it goes down here and the Freemasons say they're not associated with him, he wasn't a Freemason, I find no reason to not believe that.
Exactly.
I wouldn't argue that.
I wouldn't either.
I mean, nobody more than the Freemasons would want to be associated with this very prominent president.
Exactly. They could take credit themselves saying, right, look at our boy. But
they did not. They say it did not exist. And, Justin, that leads us to Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton.
You know, and I love this story, and I know we're going a little bit off topic, but when I was a kid, they had a milk commercial where he had the peanut butter in his mouth, and the question came on, who shot Alexander Hamilton in that famous duel? And he had the peanut butter in his mouth, and he kept trying to say Aaron Burr, and he was looking all around, and he owned the bullet that killed him, the gun that was fired, and the portrait of this gun battle was above his desk, and he couldn't say the words, and they hung up on him, and it said, got milk. And from this day, I still remember when I was little, I was like, who's Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton? But basically, to tell the story, prior to the election of 1804, Aaron Burr decided to resign as vice president due to his low political status. He announced he would run for governor. Alexander Hamilton was furious about this. He worked day and night to deny him the title. Burr thought Hamilton was bad-mouthing him and wrote a letter demanding the truth. Hamilton admitted he had made some unwelcoming remarks. I'm sure he was tearing him a new one, so to speak.
Yeah.
And he challenged him to the duel. The two men met in July 11th in Weehawken,
New Jersey.
Now, basically, Burr fired the fastest shot that would kill Alexander Hamilton. And Burr's political career was over by the bad reputation he received. So he traveled westward to the Louisiana territory. Now, this is where, Andy, I believe you told me one of the coolest stories I think I'd ever heard, early American.
Right. After Burr kills Hamilton, he travels west, and he conspires with General James Wilkinson to move the newly acquired Louisiana territory and create his own country. So he had visions of grandeur here. And Wilkinson was a spy for the Spanish. And I believe there's actually a book out about Wilkinson and his journeys as a spy. But Wilkinson, being a spy for the Spanish, he was passing information regarding the Corpse of Discovery. And he would alert Thomas Jefferson of Burr's conspiracy. Weird, I know. He's a spy for the Spanish, alerts Thomas Jefferson. Real weird situation. But Burr would be arrested for treason and tried by Judge John Marshall, who did not like Thomas Jefferson because of the whole Marbury-Madison deal. And Burr would be acquitted of the charges, much to Jefferson's dismay. And actually, as they were... I want to go back here, but Burr, when they were conspiring to form their own country in the new Louisiana territory, they were looking at Texas, and they thought about starting a war with Mexico. So it would have been the first Mexican-American war. It would have been the first one. They tried that.
And it failed.
Yeah, well, the guy, you know, narked on Burr for what he was trying to do. And we just looked up on YouTube as well. Do a search for Aaron Burr milk commercial. It's pretty funny. It's definitely worth a look. And back on track here, in June of 1807, the U.S. ship Chesapeake was boarded by British ship Leopold, and four members taken captive. Americans cried war, but Jefferson knew the country was in no condition to fight another war, and instead he retaliated with economic sanctions. An embargo was placed on American ships that forbid them from sailing into foreign ports, and foreign ships were forbid to trade in America. In the end, however, this embargo would only hurt American merchants. I mean, think about it. You can't get a foreign ship to come into America, so you've got to wait for American ships to go somewhere else, but American ships can't sail into foreign ports. I mean, how do you trade?
You don't.
And this would lead into the James Madison and the War of 1812, as we'll cover in our next podcast. But that was basically Jefferson's last moments as president, and he would retire. His crowning achievements in retirement, which we'll cover. The one that I like the most, Library of Congress, and at the Library of Congress we have the Jefferson Building. Here's why. But the Library of Congress, there's at least two buildings I know of. There's the Jefferson Building and then the John Adams Building. So there's two separate buildings for the Library of Congress. And after the original Library of Congress was burnt in 1812, Jefferson sold his personal collection of over 6,500 books to the government. His collection would form the nucleus for today's Library of Congress collection. Hence, the Jefferson Building. Then we have the Jefferson Bible, originally called The Philosophy of the Jesus of Nazareth. Jefferson was thought to be a deist, and he had the idea that we only need rational thought to understand God, not faith. And Jefferson's thoughts on Jesus, he didn't believe God would send his son to earth, since God doesn't meddle in human affairs. And Jefferson thought of Jesus to be a great philosopher. He put him on the same level as Aristotle, Socrates, and Plato. And he loved Jesus' parables, but he didn't like the evangelists who wrote them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And he would, in his Bible, he cut out the parts he didn't think Jesus wrote, and he kept the parts he felt really inspiring.
And another thing, he founded the University of Virginia, which opened in 1825. First school built around a library, not a church.
Which would go back to the separation of church and state.
First school to implement electorates. Excuse me. Jefferson invited small groups of students to Monticello for dinner. Now, I'm going to just add a little bit of this, just to kind of jump back to the presidency. Basically, when you're the president, you become pretty famous. And in retirement, one thing that he did was he actually had a lot of people over to Monticello. He had so many people staying in his house, and he didn't want to be rude because of quote-unquote Southern hospitality, that they would all stay in his house, eat his food, drink his wine, and he'd stay in a little lodge, so to speak, outside of Monticello. And you can still see it. It's on the website. If you go, he would sleep out there while all these strangers were in his home, but because of Southern hospitality, he didn't kick them out. One of his guests was thought to be Edgar Allan Poe, who attended the University of Virginia in 1826.
Right, and when he was building the University of Virginia, I mean, it took years to build, and he would go to a room in Monticello, and he would look out one of the big windows he had, and would be looking through his telescope, and he could look down on the progress the construction crew was making on the University of Virginia.
That's pretty cool.
It's really cool. And July 4th, 1826, Jefferson dies. Dies with John Adams the same day. Jefferson was originally buried at Monticello, and his tombstone would read, "He wanted to be remembered for three things," and he would have this inscribed on his tombstone: "Here was buried Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of American Independence, 1, of the Statue of Virginia for Religious Freedom, 2, and father of the University of Virginia, 3. When you think of all the other things he did in his life, such as drafting the Declaration of Independence, actually authoring the Declaration of Independence, and the Louisiana Purchase.
Going
to France.
Bringing back
all these foods, wine.
But going back to Louisiana Purchase, we see it as a monumental achievement. He was almost ashamed of it because he went against his principles.
Right.
So
right, he was.
You believe in something and then you turn around and do something else. And he felt like a hypocrite as well. So that's probably why he didn't include that, even though we see it as a huge achievement.
Right. And this brings us to the art section of Thomas Jefferson. Wasn't a whole lot to cover. We'd more have some structures. The Jefferson Memorial, which was completed in 1943. Pretty amazing.
Gorgeous building.
Gorgeous building. National Mall, Washington, D.C. You can go see it. You can see it online. There's some amazing pictures. It's well lit. It's got its own parking lot. And it's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing place. It's actually, I want our viewers to take special interest into the dome structure of the Jefferson Memorial and compare it to the dome structure of the Library of the University of Virginia.
Similarities,
yes, I might say. And then also look at the rounded scope of the building of the Library of the University of Virginia and the columns on front along with the triangle in the middle of the building. And if you look at the Jefferson Memorial, it looks darn near similar. Very interesting. I say that was done on purpose. Justin?
I agree. I concur.
We also have one of the most famous portraits of Jefferson. It's the Jefferson portrait by Charles Wilson Peale in 1791. We'd also like to... I like the Jefferson Pier survey marker. It's kind of neat. It's got some mystery to it. It says, position of Jefferson Pier erected December 18th, 1804... recovered and re-erected December 2nd, 1889, District of Columbia. And what's really interesting is between the December 2nd, 1889 and the District of Columbia, there's a line on this stone marker that has been carved out. Nobody knows what it used to say. So,
and it goes all the way across, so it wasn't just a date.
Right.
It said something.
They didn't take an eraser to it. They took a chisel and a hammer.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty neat. I mean, there's just a little bit of mystery there. Jefferson's original tombstone is now located on the campus of the University of Missouri. Jefferson's body, obviously, still at Monticello.
Which you probably can see on the website.
Yes, you can, I think. For sure.
Visit it.
And that puts us a little over an hour.
Yeah, that's Thomas Jefferson in a nutshell.
Fast as we could go.
Yeah, we wanted to keep it around an hour. Like I said, a lot more we could have went in detail to. That the Lewis and Clark expedition. I mean, that's a whole podcast in itself.
Right.
I mean, that's a History Channel special, for crying out loud. That'd take some time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we could go in a lot more detail, but that was Thomas Jefferson.
Right. And next episode, James Madison, and one of my favorites, the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff with Madison. So, next time we'll try to get it to you a little bit quicker.
Yes, than a month off.
Yeah, a month off.
We had some things come up, mostly my problems, but we'll try to navigate through those and
get it up as soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
But once again, we want to thank all our viewers. We appreciate your support. Me and Andy have a great time with this. So, if you could really help us out, the donations would be great because we want to keep doing these for you.
Definitely.
I'm Justin Hooper.
And I'm Andy Lemon. We'll see you back here next time. Episode number 5, James Madison.
How'd you get from the bar to this mattress? And when you got here, then what happened? And where's the who that lives here in this house? Wanna figure out how'd you get here? But the thought got cut by nature. Find a bathroom, the gut got anger. Here it comes, can't avoid it. Ain't the first time throwing up in a strange toilet. Anyone else would leave, but you crawl back to the bed and fell back asleep. All we need is because come and party with us. Take care of you when you're passed out.